New Millennium Entertainment presents The Salmon of Doubt, Hitchhiking the Galaxy One Last Time, written by Douglas Adams, read by Simon Jones, with contributions from
Stephen Fry,
Richard Dawkins,
Christopher Cerf.
Introduction by Stephen Fry. This is a very Douglassy moment for me. Douglassy moments are most likely to involve Apple Macintosh computers, impossible deadlines, Ed Victor, endangered species, excessively expensive five-star hotels. I am tapping at a Macintosh computer as I fight a deadline imposed on me by Ed Victor, Douglas's agent. Would I please see if I might provide a foreword for The Salmon of Doubt by next Tuesday? I am in the most outrageously luxurious hotel in Peru, the Miraflores Park Hotel Lima, enjoying the encellophaned bowls of fruit and Louis Roederer as I prepare to go upcountry in pursuit of spectacled bears, one of the least understood and most threatened mammals on the planet. Being an expensive hotel, high-bandwidth internet connections are available in each room, and I've just watched a two-hour film on my computer of Steve Jobs, Apple's CEO, making his keynote address to the Macintosh Expo in San Francisco. The Emperor of Computer Cool has just unveiled the new iMac, and I haven't been able to call up or email Douglas to talk about it. A new revolutionary piece of sexy and extraordinary Apple hardware, and Douglas won't get to see it. He won't have played with an iPod or messed around in iPhoto. To anyone who knew Douglas, and I'm including his millions of readers here, the misery and frustration of this will be appallingly evident. It is dreadful for him, because he's missed new stuff. And it is dreadful for us, because the new stuff will never now be celebrated by the acknowledged poet of new stuff. You see, I want to know what to think. I want to know what the new machines look like. Yes, I can use my own eyes and my own sensibility, but I've got used to the superior insights offered by Douglas. He would have offered the exact epithet, the perfect metaphor, the crowning simile, not just on the subject of new stuff, of course. He would have found a way of linking the amiably odd behaviour and character of spectacled bears both to familiar human experience and to abstract scientific thought. Much of the world that we move in has been seen through Douglas's eyes and become clearer. Which is to say, the very confusion and absurd lack of clarity of our world has become clearer. We never quite knew how conflicting and insane the universe was, or how ludicrous and feeble-minded the human race could be, until Douglas explained it in the uniquely affable, paradoxical, and unforced style that marks him out for greatness. I've just visited the bathroom and noted that the soap on offer there, tightly sealed in that absurdly unopenable disc of indestructible plastic paper offered by hotels for the convenience of their guests, is not called soap at all. It is, in fact, an almond facial bar. That would have been an email to Douglas straight away, and the email back, which can now never, ever be had, would have made me giggle and dance about my hotel room for half an hour. Everyone heard, in the sad weeks following his shocking and unfair death, how good a comic writer Douglas was, how far-ranging his interests and how broad his appeal. This book shows what a teacher he was. Just as sunsets have never been the same colour or shape since Turner looked at them, so a lima and a cup of tea will never be the same again because of Douglas's acute and quizzical gaze. It is very unfair to be asked to write an introduction to a book which contains an absolutely brilliant introduction written on the very subject of introductions to books. It is even more unfair to be asked to write an introduction to the posthumous work of one of the great comic writers of our age, when the book one is introducing contains the definitive introduction to the posthumous work of the definitive comic writer of all ages, Douglas's foreword to P.G. Wodehouse's Sunset at Blandings, as Ed Victor pointed out at Douglas's memorial service in London, serves as an astonishingly accurate description of Douglas's own gifts. Not that this was for a second in Douglas's mind when he wrote it. Douglas was not hideously Englishly modest, which is not to say that he was vain or boastful either. His passion to communicate his ideas and enthusiasms, however, could easily trap you on the telephone, over a dinner table, or in a bathroom, to the exclusion of all other company or considerations. In that sense, and I don't think I'm being disrespectful here, Douglas could, mano a mano, tete-a-tete, talk one into the ground. Affably wearing, but exhausting all the same. But he could no more write boringly than he could execute a perfect pirouette. And, believe me, there have been few human beings born less able to execute pirouettes without the destruction of furniture and all hope of safety to innocent bystanders than Douglas Noel Adams. He was a writer. There are those who write from time to time and do it well, and there are writers. Douglas, and it is pointless to attempt here an explanation or anatomization, was born, grew up, and remained a writer to his too early dying day. For the last 10 years or so of his life, he ceased to be a novelist, but he never for a second stopped being a writer. And it is that happy fact that The Salmon of Doubt celebrates. Whether in the preparation of lectures, the execution of occasional journalism, or in articles for specialized scientific or technical publications, Douglas's natural ability to put one word after another in the service of awakening, delighting, bamboozling, affirming, informing, or amusing the mind of the reader never deserted him. His is an egoless style where every trope and every trick available to writing is used when and only when it serves the purposes of the piece. I think, when you listen to this book, you will be astonished by the apparent, and utterly misleading, simplicity of his style. You feel he's talking to you, almost off the cuff. But as with Woodhouse, the ease and sweet running of his authorial engine was the result of a great deal of tuning and oily wrenching of nuts and gaskets. Douglas has in common with certain rare artists, Woodhouse again included, the ability to make the beholder feel that he is addressing them and them alone. I think this in part explains the immense strength and fervour of his fan base, if I can use so revolting a phrase. When you look at Velasquez, listen to Mozart, read Dickens, or laugh at Billy Connolly, to take four names at random — it always takes a great deal of time and thought to take names at random for the purposes of argument — you are aware that what they do for the world, and the results are, of course, magnificent. But when you look at Blake, listen to Bach, read Douglas Adams, or watch Eddie Izzard perform, you feel you are perhaps the only person in the world who really gets them. Just about everybody else admires them, of course, but no one really connects with them in the way you do. I advance this as a theory. Douglas's work is not the high art of Bach or the intense personal cosmos of Blake, it goes without saying, but I believe my view holds nonetheless. It's like falling in love. When an especially peachy Adams turn of phrase or epithet enters the eye and penetrates the brain, you want to tap the shoulder of the nearest stranger and share it. The stranger might laugh and seem to enjoy the writing, but you hug to yourself the thought that they didn't quite understand its force and quality the way you do, just as your friends, thank heavens, don't also fall in love with the person you are going on and on about to them. You are on the verge of entering the wise, provoking, benevolent, hilarious, and addictive world of Douglas Adams. Don't bolt it all whole. As with Douglas's beloved Japanese food, what seems light and easy to assimilate is subtler and more nutritious by far than might at first appear. The bottom drawer of recently deceased writers is often best left firmly locked and bolted. In the case of Douglas, I'm sure you'll agree, the bottom drawer, or in his case, the nested subfolders of his hard drive, has been triumphantly well worth the prizing open. Peter Guzzardi and Douglas's wife Jane have done a wonderful job. A Douglasless world is much less pleasant than a Douglas full world, but the leaping of the Salmon of Doubt helps put off the full melancholy of his sudden departure.
Eulogy for Douglas Adams by Richard Dawkins, spoken at his memorial service in the Church of St. Martin in the Fields, London, 17th of September, 2001. I believe it falls to me to say something about Douglas's love of science. He once asked my advice. He was contemplating going back to university to read science, I think specifically my own subject of zoology. I advised against it. He already knew plenty of science. It rings through almost every line he wrote and through the best jokes he made. As a single example, think of the infinite improbability drive. Douglas's ear for science was finely tuned. He thought like a scientist, but was much funnier. It is fair to say that he was a hero to scientists and technologists, especially in the computer industry. His unjustified humility in the presence of scientists came out touchingly in a magnificent impromptu speech at a Cambridge conference which I attended in 1998. He was invited as a kind of honorary scientist, a thing that happened to him quite often. Thank goodness somebody switched on a tape recorder, and so we have the whole of this splendid extempore tour de force. I'm going to read a few disconnected paragraphs. He was a wonderful comedian as well as a brilliant comic writer, and you can hear his voice in every line. This was originally billed as a debate only because I was a bit anxious coming here. In a room full of such luminaries, I thought, what could I, as an amateur, possibly have to say? So I thought I would settle for a debate. But after having been here for a couple of days, I realized you're just a bunch of guys. I thought that what I'd do is stand up and have a debate with myself, and hope sufficiently to provoke and inflame opinion that there'll be an outburst of chair-throwing at the end. Before I embark on what I want to try and tackle, may I warn you that things may get a little bit lost from time to time, because there's a lot of stuff that's just come in from what we've been hearing today, so if I occasionally sort of go... I have a 4-year-old daughter, and was very, very interested watching her face when she was in her first 2 or 3 weeks of life, and suddenly realizing what nobody would have realized in previous ages, she was rebooting. I just want to mention one thing which is completely meaningless, but I'm terribly proud of. I was born in Cambridge in 1952, and my initials are DNA. These inspired switches of subject are so characteristic of his style, and so endearing. I remember once, a long time ago, needing a definition of life for a speech I was giving. Assuming there was a simple one, and looking around the internet, I was astonished at how diverse the definitions were, and how very, very detailed each one had to be in order to include this, but not include that. If you think about it, a collection that includes a fruit fly and Richard Dawkins and the Great Barrier Reef is an awkward set of objects to try and compare. Douglas laughed at himself and at his own jokes. It was one of many ingredients of his charm. There are some oddities in the perspective with which we see the world. The fact that we live at the bottom of a deep gravity well, on the surface of a gas-covered planet going around a nuclear fireball 90 million miles away, and think this to be normal, is obviously some indication of how skewed our perspective tends to be. This next paragraph is one of Douglas's set pieces, which will be familiar to some people here. I heard it more than once, and I thought it was more brilliant every time. Imagine a puddle waking up one morning and thinking, this is an interesting world I find myself in, an interesting hole I find myself in. Fits me rather neatly, doesn't it? In fact, it fits me staggeringly well. Must have been made to have me in it. This is such a powerful idea that as the sun rises in the sky and the air heats up, and as, gradually, the puddle gets smaller and smaller, it's still frantically hanging on to the notion that everything's going to be all right, because this world was meant to have him in it, was built to have him in it. So the moment he disappears, catches him rather by surprise. I think this may be something we need to be on the watch out for. Douglas introduced me to Lala. They had worked together years ago on Doctor Who, and it was she who pointed out to me that he had a wonderful childlike capacity to go straight for the wood and never mind the trees. If you try and take a cat apart to see how it works, the first thing you have on your hands is a non-working cat. Life is a level of complexity that almost lies outside our vision. It is so far beyond anything we have any means of understanding that we just think of it as a different class of object, a different class of matter. Life, something that had a mysterious essence about it, was God-given, and that's the only explanation we had. The bombshell comes in 1859, when Darwin publishes On the Origin of Species. It takes a long time before we really get to grips with this and begin to understand it, because not only does it seem incredible and thoroughly demeaning to us, but it's yet another shock to our system to discover that not only are we not the centre of the universe, and we're not made of anything, but we started out as some kind of slime and got to where we are via being a monkey. It just doesn't read well. I am happy to say that Douglas's acquaintance with a particular modern book on evolution, which he chanced upon in his early 30s, seems to have been something of a Damascus experience for him. It all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise, naturally, to all of the infinite and baffling complexity of life. The awe it inspired in me made the awe that people talk about in respect of religious experience seem, frankly, silly beside it. I take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance any day. I once interviewed Douglas on television for a program I was making on my own love affair with science. I ended up by asking him, "What is it about science that really gets your blood running?" And here is what he said, again impromptu, and all the more passionate for that. "The world is a thing of utter, inordinate complexity and richness and strangeness that is absolutely awesome. I mean the idea that such complexity can arise not only out of such simplicity, but probably absolutely out of nothing, is the most fabulous, extraordinary idea. And once you get some kind of inkling of how that might have happened, it's just wonderful. And the opportunity to spend 70 or 80 years of your life in such a universe is time well spent as far as I'm concerned." That last sentence, of course, has a tragic ring for us now. It has been our privilege to know a man whose capacity to make the best of a full lifespan was as great as was his charm and his humour and his sheer intelligence. If ever a man understood what a magnificent place the world is, it was Douglas. And if ever a man left it a better place for his existence, it was Douglas. It would have been nice if he'd given us the full 70 or 80 years. But by God, we got our money's worth from the 49. Lament for Douglas by Richard Dawkins. Published in The Guardian, 14th of May, 2001. This is not an obituary. There'll be time enough for them. It is not a tribute, not a considered assessment of a brilliant life, not a eulogy. It is a keening lament, written too soon to be balanced, too soon to be carefully thought through. Douglas, you cannot be dead. A sunny Saturday morning in May, 7:10, shuffle out of bed, log into email as usual. The usual blue bold headings drop into place, mostly junk, some expected, and my gaze absently follows them down the page. The name Douglas Adams catches my eye, and I smile. That one, at least, will be good for a laugh. Then I do the classic double take, back up the screen. What did that heading actually say? Douglas Adams died of a heart attack a few hours ago. Then that other cliché, the words swelling before my eyes. It must be part of the joke. It must be some other Douglas Adams. This is too ridiculous to be true. I must be still asleep. I open the message, from a well-known German software designer. It is no joke. I am fully awake. And it is the right, or rather the wrong, Douglas Adams. A sudden heart attack in the gym in Santa Barbara. Man, 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 oh man. The message concludes. Man indeed, what a man! A giant of a man, surely nearer 7 foot than 6, broad-shouldered, and he did not stoop like some very tall men who feel uncomfortable with their height. But nor did he swagger with the macho assertiveness that can be intimidating in a big man. He neither apologized for his height nor flaunted it. It was part of the joke against himself. one of the great wits of our age, his sophisticated humour was founded in a deep, amalgamated knowledge of literature and science, two of my great loves. And he introduced me to my wife at his 40th birthday party. He was exactly her age. They had worked together on Doctor Who. Should I tell her now, or let her sleep a bit longer before shattering her day? He initiated our togetherness and was a recurrently important part of it. I must tell her now. Douglas and I met because I sent him an unsolicited fan letter. I think it is the only time I've ever written one. I had adored The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Then I read Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. As soon as I finished it, I turned back to page one and read it straight through again. The only time I've ever done that. And I wrote to tell him so. He replied that he was a fan of my books, and he invited me to his house in London. I've seldom met a more congenial spirit. Obviously, I knew he would be funny. What I didn't know was how deeply read he was in science. I should have guessed, for you can't understand many of the jokes in Hitchhiker if you don't know a lot of advanced science. And in modern electronic technology, he was a real expert. We talked science a lot, in private and even in public, at literary festivals and on the wireless or television. And he became my guru on all technical problems. Rather than struggle with some ill-written and incomprehensible manual in Pacific Rim English, I would fire off an email to Douglas. He would reply, often within minutes, whether in London or Santa Barbara or some hotel room anywhere in the world. Unlike most staffers of professional helplines, Douglas understood exactly my problem, knew exactly why it was troubling me, and always had the solution ready, lucidly and amusingly explained. Our frequent email exchanges brimmed with literary and scientific jokes and affectionately sardonic little asides. His technophilia shone through, but so did his rich sense of the absurd. The whole world was one big Monty Python sketch, and the follies of humanity are as comic in the world's Silicon Valleys as anywhere else. He laughed at himself with equal good humour, at, for example, his epic bouts of writer's block. I love deadlines. I love the whooshing noise they make as they go by. When, according to legend, his publisher and book agent would literally lock him in a hotel room with no telephone and nothing to do but write, releasing him only for supervised walks. If his enthusiasm ran away with him and he advanced a biological theory too eccentric for my professional scepticism to let pass, his mien at my dismissal of it would always be more humorously self-mocking than genuinely crestfallen. And he would have another go. He laughed at his own jokes, which good comedians are supposed not to, but he did it with such charm that the jokes became even funnier. He was gently able to poke fun without wounding, and it would be aimed not at individuals, but at their absurd ideas. To illustrate the vain conceit that the universe must be somehow preordained for us, because we are so well suited to live in it, he mimed a wonderfully funny imitation of a puddle of water fitting itself snugly into a depression in the ground, the depression uncannily being exactly the same shape as the puddle. Or there's this parable, which he told with huge enjoyment, whose moral leaps out with no further explanation. A man didn't understand how televisions work, and was convinced that there must be lots of little men inside the box, manipulating images at high speed. An engineer explained to him about high-frequency modulations of the electromagnetic spectrum, about transmitters and receivers, about amplifiers and cathode ray tubes, about scan lines moving across and down a phosphorescent screen. The man listened to the engineer with careful attention, nodding his head at every step of the argument. At the end, he pronounced himself satisfied. He really did now understand how televisions work. But I expect there are just a few little men in there, aren't there? Science has lost a friend. Literature has lost a luminary. The mountain gorilla and the black rhino have lost a gallant defender. He once climbed Kilimanjaro in a rhino suit to raise money to fight the cretinous trade in rhino horn. Apple Computer has lost its most eloquent apologist, and I have lost an irreplaceable intellectual companion, and one of the kindest and funniest men I ever met. I officially received a happy piece of news yesterday, which would have delighted him. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone during the weeks I've secretly known about it, and now that I am allowed to, it is too late. The sun is shining, life must go on, seize the day, and all those clichés. We shall plant a tree this very day, a Douglas fir, tall, upright, evergreen. It is the wrong time of year, but we'll give it our best shot. Off to the Arboretum.
Douglas Adams was, in every sense of the word, larger than life. To begin with, he was prodigious in stature, towering over the world at 6'5" or more. Indeed, even as a child on school trips, Douglas writes, his teachers wouldn't say, "Meet under the clock tower," or "Meet under the war memorial," but "Meet under Adams." He was larger than life as a personality, too, expansive and joyous and perpetually curious, always intrigued by new opportunities and eager to pursue them with a single-mindedness and charm that usually proved irresistible. I had the good fortune to have lunch with him in Islington a few hours after he had received a formal invitation as a result of his recent embrace of the Save the Rhino International movement, offering him the opportunity to get dressed up as a rhinoceros and, despite being weighed down by the cumbersome costume, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest peak in Africa. The event was apparently imminent. And, of course, the proposed date for the climb coincided with several important writing deadlines. Douglas was also peerless in his ability to procrastinate, but more about that later. "Are you going to do it?" I asked. "Of course," he replied. "Why wouldn't I?" And he did, an adventure recounted in The Rhino Climb, which appears for the first time in book form in The Salmon of Doubt. One of Douglas's most endearing attributes was the incessant delight he took in sharing his wide-ranging and always evolving ideas and enthusiasms with virtually anyone who seemed to appreciate them. Indeed, it was this quality, along with his unparalleled humor, kindness, and generosity, that made him such a unique and wonderful friend. I first met him at an American Booksellers Association convention in the early 1980s. We were introduced by our mutual colleague and literary agent, Ed Victor, who knew that I was an unabashed hitchhiker fanatic and that Douglas had become intrigued with a medium that I had been busy learning about, the computer text adventure, a genre of interactive fiction that, as Douglas himself has characterized it, allows the storyteller to, quote, respond to the audience rather than just having the audience respond to the storyteller, end quote. Douglas and I, it turned out, were both fascinated by the prospect of trying to anticipate what readers might type into their computers under various circumstances and coming up with witty and hopefully surprising prepackaged rejoinders. Luckily, I had met Mark Blank, co-creator of Invocom's groundbreaking Zork adventure game, and was able to introduce him to Douglas, a meeting that I'm proud to say helped pave the way for Infocom's eventual publication of Douglas's marvelous Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, which he wrote in collaboration with Steve Zaretsky, and set the stage, many years later, for his award-winning resurrection of the text-adventure format with Starship Titanic. It wasn't long before Douglas and I had discovered several more common passions, the Pythons and Beyond the Fringe and the Goon Show, the then-newly-released Macintosh computer, the Weekly World News, the funniest tabloid on the planet, and the remarkably eclectic music of Procol Harum and their pianist lead singer, Gary Brooker, whose work, we instantly agreed, had, with the exception of A Whiter Shade of Pale, never really gotten the attention it deserved. I was amazed to learn that the group's Grand Hotel, one of my favorite songs of all time, had been the inspiration for Douglas's second Hitchhiker book, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. The reference to Procol Harum brings to mind an incident that demonstrates what many of Douglas's friends regard as perhaps his most seductive quality, his unflagging ability to get us to do things that we were secretly dying to do, but somehow thought were indefensibly silly or irresponsible. I was sitting in my New York apartment one afternoon in the early 90s, just a day or two before I was to fly across the Pacific to Japan to meet Douglas and a few hundred others at an international conference sponsored by Apple Computer, when I received a breathless call from him. "If I can persuade Gary Brooker to have dinner with me in London the day after our meetings are done with," he said, "will you promise to fly back to New York via the UK and join us?" Have you actually ever met Gary Brooker? I asked. Not yet, he confessed. In fact, I'm not even exactly sure how to find him. But England is a small country. So then, will you promise? I did, and the next thing I knew, having traveled 3/4 of the way around the world in less than a week, I found myself sitting with Douglas, his wife Jane, and a somewhat puzzled Gary Brooker at the Adamses' dinner table in Islington. We happily peppered Brooker with questions about his career and work, and it turned out, why should it have been a surprise, that Douglas, there was apparently nothing he couldn't do well, actually remembered some of Gary's songs better than Gary did, and sat down at the piano to remind him how to play them. Above all, of course, Douglas Adams was a transcendent, multifaceted comic genius. What made Douglas's work unique, I think, were the wildly contradictory attributes he displayed in his writing. He seamlessly blended world-class intelligence and a daunting knowledge about an impossible variety of subjects, literature, computers, evolution, pop culture, genetics and music, to name but a few, with cosmic silliness, technophobia with a lust for and fascination with every high-tech toy imaginable, deep cynicism about virtually everything with an effusively joyful spirit, and one of the quickest wits I've ever encountered with a relentless perfectionism in pursuing his craft. Mix in a bit of impish mischief, if indeed anyone who weighed over 260 pounds could ever be accused of being impish, an unrivaled sense of irony, and a peculiar knack for making absurd yet logical connections, and you get such one-of-a-kind creations as the line of electromechanical security robots who repeatedly shout, "Resistance is useless," even as they're destroyed by their attackers. Or the guidebook publisher who, after carefully reviewing every aspect of life on Earth, decides that all the useful information a space traveler could ever want about the human race can be summed up in the phrase, "mostly harmless." Or, to choose an example from the tantalizing fragment of Douglas's unfinished and oft-postponed next novel that appears in this volume, the cab driver who, having noted that no one has ever jumped into his taxi and shouted the much ballyhooed phrase, "Follow that cab," reaches the obvious conclusion that his must be the cab that all the other cabs are following. The writings collected in The Salmon of Doubt were retrieved posthumously from the disk drive of Douglas's Mac and masterfully assembled by Peter Gazzardi, assisted heroically by Jane Belson, Douglas's widow, and his longtime assistant, Sophie Aston. The pieces anthologized here not only show off, as do all his books, the remarkable breadth of Douglas's interests and talent, but also reveal, unlike his novels, the constant, irresistible invitation to share something new and exciting that opened those of us fortunate enough to know him personally to so many rewarding pursuits and pleasures. If you're at all like me, before you finished reading these pages, you'll have taken Douglas's advice and picked up a copy of Richard Dawkins's The Selfish Gene, or listened once again, perhaps more closely than ever, to the Beatles' Drive My Car or Bach's Fifth Brandenburg Concerto, or taken it upon yourself to learn more about the Dagenham Girl Pipers, or brewed, for the first time in your life, a truly proper British cup of tea. And now, at last, it's time to address Douglas's extraordinary ability to procrastinate. It has become legendary that at least three of Douglas's publishers, Sue Freestone, Sonny Mehta, and Shay Earhart, have found it necessary to lock themselves up in the same room with him for days at a time in order to get him to complete a scandalously overdue book. I've often wondered if they would have resorted to such rash measures if he weren't such delightful company. Douglas's excuses for his books being late in the first place, covering up what was actually a daunting blend of perfectionism and a terror of failing in his quest to put, as he liked to phrase it, quote, 100,000 words in a cunning order, end quote, are even more extraordinary. The rhino climb referenced above must certainly have startled the editor whose deadline Douglas missed because of it, as I'm sure did the unexpected news of his hastily arranged trip to Australia to attempt a, quote, comparative test drive, end quote, between a sub-bug, a sort of underwater jet ski designed to propel scuba divers, and a manta ray, an excursion which caused him to miss yet another crucial due date, see, quote, Riding the Rays, end quote, also reprinted in this book. Unfortunately, incomprehensibly, a heart attack that no one could have predicted has prevented Douglas from postponing the completion of his long-awaited and many times delayed next book, The Salmon of Doubt, which interviews just before his death indicate he was still many, many months, if not years, away from finishing. Would it have remained a Dirk Gently book, or would he instead have transformed it, as he hinted he might, into the sixth and final volume in the Hitchhiker trilogy? Why, I find myself wondering, didn't he find an excuse to procrastinate during his fateful trip to the gym last spring? Television viewers who tune into Between the Lions, the daily children's literacy education program Michael Frith, another of Douglas's American friends, and I helped create for PBS, will note that one of the lead characters, Lionel, habitually wears a rugby shirt featuring the number 42. This small testament may not be the answer to life, the universe, and everything, as the famed deep thought computer from the Hitchhiker trilogy determined 42 to be, but if it serves to remind people what a brilliant, unique, irreplaceable force Douglas Adams was in the lives of virtually everyone who knew or read him, well, at least it's a step in the right direction. Douglas, I loved you dearly, and I'll miss you terribly, and I'm grateful you left that hard disk behind so we can all share this one last conversation with you. Christopher Cerf, New York, February 2002.
Eagle and Boys World Magazine. Dear Editor, the sweat was dripping down my face and into my lap, making my clothes very wet and sticky. I sat there, watching. I was trembling violently as I sat, looking at the small slot, waiting, ever waiting. My nails dug into my flesh as I clenched my hands. I passed my arm over my hot, wet face down which sweat was pouring. The suspense was unbearable. I bit my lip in an attempt to stop trembling with the terrible burden of anxiety. Suddenly, the slot opened, and in dropped the mail. I grabbed at my eagle and ripped off the wrapping paper. My ordeal was over for another week. D.N. Adams, age 12, Brentwood, Essex, January 23rd, 1965. The Voices of All Our Yesterdays. I vaguely remember my school days. They were what was going on in the background while I was trying to listen to the Beatles. When Can't Buy Me Love came out, I was 12. I sneaked out of school during morning milk break, bought the record and broke into Matron's room because she had a record player. Then I played it, not loud enough to get caught, but just loud enough to hear with my ear pressed up against the speaker. Then I played it again for the other ear. Then I turned the record over and did the same for You Can't Do That. That was when the housemaster found me and put me into detention, which is what I had expected. It seemed a small price to pay for what I now realize was art. I didn't know it was art then, of course. I only knew that the Beatles were the most exciting thing in the universe. It wasn't always an easy view to live with. First, you had to fight the Stones fans, which was tricky because they fought dirty and had their knuckles nearer the ground. Then you had to fight the grown-ups, parents and teachers, who said that you were wasting your time and pocket money on rubbish that you would have forgotten by next week. I found it hard to understand why they were telling me this. I sang in the school choir and knew how to listen for harmony and counterpoint, and it was clear to me that the Beatles were something extraordinarily clever. It bewildered me that no one else could hear it. Impossible harmonies and part playing you had never heard in pop songs before. The Beatles were obviously just putting all this stuff in some secret fun of their own, and it seemed exciting to me that people could have fun in that way. The next exciting thing was that they kept on losing me. They would bring out a new album, and for a few listenings it would leave me cold and confused. Then gradually it would begin to unravel itself in my mind. I would realize that the reason I was confused was that I was listening to something that was simply unlike anything that anybody had done before. Another Girl, Good Day Sunshine, and the extraordinary Drive My Car. These tracks are so familiar now that it takes a special effort of will to remember how alien they seemed at first to me. The Beatles were now not just writing songs, they were inventing the very medium in which they were working. I never got to see them. Difficult to believe, I know. I was alive at the time the Beatles were performing and never got to see them. I tend to go on about this rather a lot. Do not go to San Francisco with me, or I will insist on pointing out Candlestick Park to you and bleating on about the fact that in 1966 the Beatles played their last concert there just shortly before I'd woken up to the fact that rock concerts were things you could actually go to, even if you lived in Brentwood. A friend of mine at school once had some studio tickets to see David Frost's show being recorded, but we ended up not going. I watched the show that night, and the Beatles were on it, playing Hey Jude. I was ill for about a year. Another day that I happened not to go to London after all was the day they played their rooftop concert in Savile Row. I can't never, ever speak about that. Well, the years passed. The Beatles passed. But Paul McCartney has gone on and on. A few months ago, the guitarist Robbie McIntosh phoned me and said, "We're playing at the Mean Fiddler in a few days. Do you want to come along?" Now, this is one of the daftest questions I've ever been asked, and I think it took me a few moments even to work out what he meant. The Mean Fiddler, for those who don't know, is a pub in an unlovely part of northwest London with a room at the back where bands play. You can probably get about 200 people in. It was the word "we" that temporarily confused me, because I knew that the band that Robbie was currently playing in was Paul McCartney's, and I didn't think that Paul McCartney played in pubs. If Paul McCartney did play in pubs, then it would be daft to think that I would not saw my own leg off in order to go. I went. In front of 200 people in a pub, Paul McCartney stood up and played songs he'd never, I think, played in public before. "Here, There and Everywhere," and "Blackbird," to name but two. I've played "Blackbird" in pubs, for heaven's sake. I spent weeks learning the guitar part when I was supposed to be revising for A-levels. I almost wondered if I was hallucinating. There were, though, two moments of complete astonishment. One was the last encore, which was an immaculate, thunderous performance of, believe it or not, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Remember, this was in a pub. And the other was one of the world's greatest rock and roll songs, "Can't Buy Me Love," which I had first heard crouching with my ear cupped to the Dansette record player in the school matron's room. There is a game people like to play which goes, when would you most like to have lived and why? The Italian Renaissance? Mozart's Vienna? Shakespeare's England? Personally, I would like to have been around Bach, but I have a real difficulty with the game, which is that living at any other period of history would have meant missing the Beatles, and I honestly don't think I could do that. Mozart and Bach and Shakespeare are always with us, but I grew up with the Beatles, and I'm not sure what else has affected me as much as that. So Paul McCartney is 50 tomorrow. Happy birthday, Paul. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. The London Sunday Times, Wednesday, June the 17th, 1992. Shorts. I was at Brentwood School for 12 whole years, and they were, by and large, in an up-and-downy kind of way, pretty good years. Fairly happy, reasonably leafy, a bit sportier than I was in the mood for at the time, but full of good and sometimes highly eccentric teaching. In fact, it was only later that I gradually came to realise how well I had been taught at Brentwood, particularly in English, and particularly in physics. Odd, that. However, the whole 12-year experience is for me completely overshadowed by the memory of one terrible, mind-scarring experience. I am referring to the episode of the trousers. Let me explain. I have always been absurdly, ridiculously tall. To give you an idea, when we went on school expeditions to interesting and improving places, the form master wouldn't say, "Meet under the clock tower," or "Meet under the war memorial," but "Meet under Adams." I was at least as visible as anything else on the horizon, and could be repositioned at will. When in physics we were asked to repeat Galileo's demonstration that two bodies of different weight fall to the ground at the same speed, I was the one who was given the task of dropping the cricket ball and the pea, because it was quicker than going to an upstairs window. I always towered over everybody. Right back at the very beginning of my school career, age 7, I introduced myself to another new boy, Robert Neary, by coming up behind him and, in a spirit of experiment, dropping a cricket ball on his head and saying, "Hello, my name's Adams. What's yours?" This, for Robert Neary, I'm sure, was his one terrible, mind-scarring memory. In the prep school, where I was for 5 years out of my 12, we all wore short trousers. Grey shorts with blazers in the summer, and in the winter those pepper-and-salt tweed suits with short trousers. There is, of course, an extremely good reason for wearing shorts when you are young, even in the depths of an English winter. And they were colder then, weren't they? According to Wired magazine, we can't expect to see self-repairing fabrics until about the year 2020. But ever since we emerged from whatever trees or swamps we lived in 5 million years ago, we have had self-repairing knees. Incidentally, the worst damage I ever did to my knees was on the morning of Friday, March the 20th, 1964. The Beatles' "Can't Buy Me Love, You Can't Do That" was released that day, so, quite reasonably, I think, I broke out of school, ran a mile to Radiogram in the High Street, bought a copy, ran back, climbed into Matron's sitting room window, taking a lot of skin off my knees in the process, hunkered down, bleeding profusely in front of her record player, and managed to play both sides about 3 times before I was caught, bandaged, and slippered. I didn't care. It was the Beatles. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, shorts. We had to wear them. Even though we all had to wear them, it did begin to get a bit ridiculous in my case. It wasn't so much towering over the other boys I minded so much. It was towering over the masters, wearing shorts. My mother pleaded with the principal on one occasion to please make an exception in my case and let me wear long trousers. But Jack Higgs, ever fair but firm, said no. I was only 6 months away from going up to the main school, whereupon I, along with everybody else, would be able to wear long trousers. I would have to wait. At last I left the prep school, and 2 weeks before the beginning of the Michaelmas term, my mother took me along to the school shop to buy, at last, a long-trousered school suit. And guess what? They didn't make them in a size long enough for me. Let me just repeat that, so that the full horror of the situation can settle on you reading this, as it did on me that day in the summer of 1964, standing in the school shop. They didn't have any school trousers long enough for me. They would have to make them specially. That would take 6 weeks. 6 weeks! 6 minus 2 was, as we had been so carefully and painstakingly taught, 4. Which meant that for 4 whole weeks of the next term, I was going to be the only boy in school wearing shorts. For the next 2 weeks, I took up playing in the traffic, being careless with kitchen knives and neglecting to stand clear of the doors on station platforms. But, sadly, I led a charmed life, and I had to go through with it. 4 weeks of the greatest humiliation and embarrassment known to man, or rather to that most easily humiliated and embarrassed of all creatures, the overgrown 12-year-old boy. We've all experienced those painful dreams in which we suddenly discover we are stark naked in the middle of the high street. Believe me, this was worse, and it wasn't a dream. The story rather fizzles out there, because a month later, of course, I got my long trousers and was readmitted into polite society. But believe me, I still carry the scars inside, and though I try my best to bestride the world like a colossus, writing best-selling books and... well, that's about it, really, I suppose. If I ever come across as a maladjusted, socially isolated, sad, hunched, emotional cripple... I'm thinking mainly of Sunday mornings in February here... then it's those 4 weeks of having to wear short trousers in September 1964 that are to blame. Why? Why is the only question which bothers people enough to have an entire letter of the alphabet named after it. The alphabet does not go A, B, C, D, what, when, how, but it does go V, W, X, Y, Z. Why is always the most difficult question to answer. You know where you are when someone asks you, what's the time, or when was the Battle of 1066, or how do these seat belts work that go tight when you slam the brakes on, Daddy? The answers are easy and are respectively 7:35 in the evening, 10:15 in the morning, and don't ask stupid questions. But when you hear the word why, you know you've got one of the most big unanswerables on your hands, such as, why are we born, or why do we die, and... why do we spend so much of the intervening time receiving junk mail? Or this one. Will you go to bed with me? Why? There's only ever been one good answer to that question, why, and perhaps we should have that in the alphabet as well. There's room for it. Why doesn't have to be the last word. It isn't even the last letter. How would it be if the alphabet ended not VWXYZ, but VWX, why not? Don't ask stupid questions. From Hockney's Alphabet. The meaning of LIF started life as an English exercise I had to do at school, which then got turned into a game 15 years later by John Lloyd and myself. We were sitting with a few friends in a Greek taverna, playing charades, and drinking Retsina all afternoon until we needed to find a game that didn't require so much standing up. It was simply this. It needed to be simple. The afternoon was too far advanced for complicated rules. Someone would say the name of a town, and somebody else would say what the word meant. You had to be there. We rapidly discovered that there were an awful lot of experiences, ideas, and situations that everybody knew and recognized, but which never got properly identified simply because there wasn't a word for them. They were all of the, do you ever have the situation where, or you know what feeling you get when... you know, I always thought it was just me. All it needs is a word, and the thing is identified. So, the vaguely uncomfortable feeling you got from sitting on a seat which is warm from somebody else's bottom is just as real a feeling as the one you get when a rogue giant elephant charges out of the bush at you, but hitherto only the latter has actually had a word for it. Now they both have words. The first one is shoeberiness. And the second, of course, is fear. We started to collect more and more of these words and concepts and began to realize what an arbitrarily selective work the Oxford English Dictionary is. It simply doesn't recognize huge wodges of human experience, like, for instance, standing in the kitchen wondering what you went in there for. Everybody does it, but because there isn't, or wasn't, a word for it, everyone thinks it's something that only they do, and they are therefore more stupid than other people. It is reassuring to realize that everybody is as stupid as you are, and that all we are doing when we are standing in the kitchen wondering what we came in here for is woking. Gradually, little stacks of index cards with these words on started to grow in John Lloyd's bottom drawer, and anybody who heard about them would add concepts of their own. They first saw the light of day when John Lloyd was putting together the Not 1982 calendar, and was stuck for things to go on the bottoms of the pages, and also the tops and quite a few middles. He turned out the drawer, chose a dozen or so of the best new words, and inserted them in the book under the name Oxtail English Dictionary. This quickly turned out to be one of the most popular bits of Not 1982, and the success of the idea on this small scale suggested the possibility of a book devoted to it. And here it is. The Meaning of Lif. The product of a hard lifetime's work, studying and chronicling the behaviour of man. From the introduction, The Meaning of Lif. My nose. My mother has a long nose, and my father had a wide one, and I got both of them combined. It's large. The only person I ever knew with a nose substantially larger than mine was a master at my prep school, who also had tiny little eyes, hardly any chin, and was ludicrously thin. He resembled a cross between a flamingo and an old-fashioned farming implement, and walked rather unsteadily in crosswinds. He also hid a great deal. I wanted to hide, too. As a boy, I was teased unmercifully about my nose for years, until one day I happened to catch sight of my profile in a pair of angled mirrors and had to admit that it was actually pretty funny. From that moment, people stopped teasing me about my nose and instead started to tease me unmercifully about the fact that I said words like actually, which is something that has never let up to this day. One of the more curious features of my nose is that it doesn't admit any air. This is hard to understand or even believe. The problem goes back a very long way to when I was a small boy living in my grandmother's house. My grandmother was the local representative of the RSPCA, which meant the house was always full of badly damaged dogs and cats, and even the occasional badger, stoat, or pigeon. Some of them were damaged physically, some psychologically, but the effect they had on me was to seriously damage my attention span. Because the air was thick with animal hair and dust, my nose was continually inflamed and runny, and every 15 seconds I would sneeze. Any thought I could explore, develop, and bring to some logical conclusion within 15 seconds would therefore be forcibly expelled from my head, along with a great deal of mucus. There are those who say that I tend to think and write in one-liners, and if there is any truth to this criticism, then it was almost certainly while I lived with my grandmother that the habit developed. I escaped from my grandmother's house by going to boarding school, where, for the first time in my life, I was able to breathe. This newfound, blissful freedom continued for a good 2 weeks until I had to learn to play rugby. In about the first 5 minutes of the first match I ever played, I managed to break my nose on my own knee, which, although it was clearly an extraordinary achievement, had the same effect on me that those geological upheavals had on whole civilizations in Rider Haggard novels. It effectively sealed me off from the outside world forever. Various ENT specialists have at different times embarked on major speleological expeditions into my nasal passages, but most of them have come back baffled. The ones that didn't come back baffled didn't come back at all, and are therefore now part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The only thing that ever tempted me to try taking cocaine was the dire warning that the stuff eats away at your septum. If I thought cocaine could actually find a way through my septum, I would happily shove it up there by the bucketful and let it eat away as much as it liked. I have been put off, however, by the observation that friends who do shove it up their noses by the bucketful have even shorter attention spans than me. So by now I am pretty well resigned to the fact that my nose is decorative rather than functional. Like the Hubble telescope, it represents a massive feat of engineering, but is not actually any good for anything, except perhaps a few cheap laughs. Esquire, Summer 1991. The Book That Changed Me. 1. Title: The Blind Watchmaker. 2. Author: Richard Dawkins. 3. When did you first read it? Whenever it was published, about 1990, I think. 4. Why did it strike you so much? It's like throwing open the doors and windows in a dark and stuffy room. You realize what a jumble of half-digested ideas we normally live with, particularly those of us with an arts education. We sort of understand evolution, though we secretly think there's probably a bit more to it than that. Some of us even think that there's some sort of God which takes care of the bits that sound a little bit improbable. Dawkins brings a flood of light and fresh air and shows us that there is a dazzling clarity to the structure of evolution that is breathtaking when we suddenly see it. And if we don't see it, then quite literally, we don't know the first thing about who we are and where we come from. 5. Have you reread it? If so, how many times? Yes, once or twice. But I also dip into it a lot. 6. Does it feel the same as when you first read it? Yes. The workings of evolution run so contrary to our normal intuitive assumptions about the world that there's always a fresh shock of understanding. 7. Do you recommend it, or is it a private passion? I'd recommend it to anybody and everybody. Maggie and Trudy. I am not, I should say at once, in any formal relationship with a dog. I don't feed a dog, give it a bed, groom it, find kennels for it when I'm away, de-louse it, or suddenly arrange for any of its internal organs to be removed when they displease me. I do not, in short, own a dog. On the other hand, I do have a kind of furtive, illicit relationship with a dog, or rather, two dogs, and in consequence I think I know a little of what it must be like to be a mistress. The dogs do not live next door. They don't even live in the same, well, I was going to say street and tease it out a bit, but let's cut straight to the truth. They live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a hell of a place for a dog, or indeed anyone else, to live. If you've never visited or spent time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, then let me say this. You're a complete idiot. I was myself a complete idiot until about a year ago, when a combination of circumstances, which I can't be bothered to explain, led me to borrow somebody's house way out in the desert just north of Santa Fe to write a screenplay in. To give you an idea of the sort of place that Santa Fe is, I could bang on about the desert and the altitude and the light and the silver and turquoise jewellery, but the best thing is just to mention a traffic sign on the freeway from Albuquerque. It says, in large letters, "Gusty Winds," and in smaller letters, "May Exist." I never met my neighbours. They lived half a mile away on top of the next sand ridge, but as soon as I started going out for my morning run, jog, gentle stroll, I met their dogs, who were so instantly and deliriously pleased to see me that I wondered if they thought we'd met in a previous life. Shirley MacLaine lived nearby, and they might have picked up all kinds of weird ideas from just being near her. Their names were Maggie and Trudy. Trudy was an exceptionally silly-looking dog, a large black French poodle who moved exactly as if she had been animated by Walt Disney, a kind of lollop, which was emphasized by her large floppy ears at the front end and a short stubby tail with a bit of topiary work on the end. Her coat consisted of a matting of tight black curls, which added to the general Disney effect by making it seem that she was completely devoid of naughty bits. The way in which she signified every morning that she was deliriously pleased to see me was to do a thing which I always thought was called prinking, but is in fact called stotting. I've only just discovered my error, and I'm going to have to replay whole sections of my life through my mind to see what confusions I may have caused or fallen foul of. Stotting is jumping upwards with all four legs simultaneously. My advice: do not die until you've seen a large black poodle stotting in the snow. The way in which Maggie would signify every morning that she was deliriously pleased to see me was to bite Trudy on the neck. This was also her way of signifying that she was deliriously excited at the prospect of going for a walk. It was her way of signifying that she was having a walk and really enjoying it. It was her way of signifying she wanted to be let into the house. It was her way of signifying she wanted to be let out of the house. Continuously and playfully biting Trudy on the neck was, in short, her way of life. Maggie was a handsome dog. She was not a poodle, and in fact the sort of breed of dog she was continuously on the tip of my tongue. I'm not very good with dog breeds, but Maggie was one of the real classic, obvious ones, a sleek, black and tan, vaguely retrieverish sort of big beagle sort of thing. What are they called? Labradors? Spaniels? Elkhounds? Samoyeds? I asked my friend Michael, the film producer, once I felt I knew him well enough to admit that I couldn't quite put my finger on the sort of breed of dog Maggie was, despite the fact that it was so obvious. Maggie, he said in his slow, serious Texan drawl, is a mert. So every morning the three of us would set out. Me, the large English writer, Trudy the poodle, and Maggie, the mert. I would run jog-stroll along the wide dirt track that ran through the dry red dunes. Trudy would gamble friskily along, this way and that, ears flapping, and Maggie would bowl along, cheerily biting her neck. Trudy was extraordinarily good-natured and long-suffering about this, but every now and then she would suddenly get monumentally fed up. At that moment she would execute a sudden mid-air about-turn, land squarely on her feet facing Maggie, and give her an extremely pointed look, whereupon Maggie would suddenly sit and start gently gnawing her own right rear foot, as if she was bored with Trudy anyway. Then they'd start up again and go running and rolling and tumbling, chasing and biting, out through the dunes, through the scrubby grass and undergrowth, and then every now and then would suddenly and inexplicably come to a halt, as if they had both, simultaneously, run out of moves. They would then stare into the middle distance in embarrassment for a bit, before starting up again. So what part did I play in all this? Well, none, really. They completely ignored me for the whole 20 or 30 minutes, which was perfectly fine, of course, I didn't mind. But it did puzzle me, because early every morning they would come yelping and scratching around the doors and windows of my house until I got up and took them for their walk. If anything disturbed the daily ritual, like I had to drive into town, or have a meeting, or fly to England or something, they would get thoroughly miserable and simply not know what to do. Despite the fact that they would always completely ignore me whenever we went on our walks together, they couldn't just go and have a walk without me. This revealed a profoundly philosophical bent in these dogs which were not mine, because they had worked out that I had to be there in order for them to be able to ignore me properly. You can't ignore someone who isn't there, because that's not what ignore means. Further depths to their thinking were revealed when Michael's girlfriend Victoria told me that once, when coming to visit me, she had tried to throw a ball for Maggie and Trudy to chase. The dogs had sat and watched, stony-faced, as the ball climbed up into the sky, dropped, and at last dribbled along the ground to a halt. She said that the message she was picking up from them was, "We don't do that. We hang out with writers." Which was true. They hung out with me all day, every day. But exactly like writers, dogs who hang out with writers don't like the actual writing bit. So they would moon around at my feet all day and keep nudging my elbow out of the way while I was typing, so that they could rest their chins on my lap and gaze mournfully up at me in the hope that I would see reason and go for a walk so that they could ignore me properly. And then in the evening they would trot off to their real home to be fed, watered, and put to bed for the night, which seemed to me like a fine arrangement, because I got all the pleasure of their company, which was considerable, without having any responsibility for them. And it continued to be a fine arrangement, up until the day when Maggie turned up bright and early in the morning, ready and eager to ignore me on her own. No Trudy. Trudy was not with her. I was stunned. I didn't know what had happened to Trudy, and had no way of finding out, because she wasn't mine. Had she been run over by a truck? Was she lying somewhere, bleeding by the roadside? Maggie seemed restless and worried. She would know where Trudy was, I thought, and what had happened to her. I'd better follow her, like Lassie. I put on my walking shoes and hurried out. We walked for miles, roaming around the desert looking for Trudy, following the most circuitous route. Eventually, I realized that Maggie wasn't looking for Trudy at all. She was just ignoring me. A strategy which I was complicating by trying to follow her the whole time, rather than just pursuing my normal morning walk route. So eventually I returned to the house, and Maggie sat at my feet and moped. There was nothing I could do, no one I could phone about it, because Trudy didn't belong to me. All I could do, like a mistress, was sit and worry in silence. I was off my food. After Maggie sloped off home that night, I slept badly. And in the morning, they were back. Both of them. Only something terrible had happened. Trudy had been to the groomer's. Most of her coat had been cropped down to about 2 millimetres, with a few topiary tufts on her head, ears and tail. I was outraged. She looked preposterous. We went out for a walk, and I was embarrassed, frankly. She wouldn't have looked like that if she was my dog. A few days later, I had to go back to England. I tried to explain this to them, to prepare them for it, but they were in denial. On the morning I left, They saw me putting my cases in the back of the four-wheel drive and kept their distance, becoming tremendously interested in another dog instead. Really ignored me. I flew home, feeling odd about it. 6 weeks later, I came back to work on a second draft. I couldn't just call round to get the dogs. I had to walk around in the backyard looking terribly obvious and making all sorts of high-pitched noises such as dogs are wont to notice. Suddenly, they got the message and raced across the snow-covered desert to see me. This was mid-January now. Once they had arrived, they continually hurled themselves at the walls in excitement. But then there wasn't much else we could do but go out for a brisk, healthy ignore in the snow. Trudy stotted, Maggie bit her on the neck, and so we went on. And 3 weeks later I left again. I'll be back again to see them sometime this year, but I realise that I'm the other human. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to commit to a dog of my own. Written in 1994. In the old Soviet Union, they used to say that anything that wasn't forbidden was compulsory. The trick was to remember which was which. In the West, we've always congratulated ourselves on taking a slightly more relaxed, common-sense view of things, and forget that common sense is often just as arbitrary. You've got to know the rules, especially if you travel. A few years ago, well, I can tell you exactly, in fact, it was early 1994, I had a little run-in with the police. I was driving along Westway into central London with my wife, who was 6 months pregnant, and I overtook on the inside lane. Not a piece of wild and reckless driving in the circumstances. Honestly, it was just the way the traffic was flowing. But anyway, I suddenly found myself being flagged down by a police car. The policeman signalled me to follow them down the motorway and, astonishingly, to stop behind them on a bend in the slip road, where we could all get out and have a little chat about my heinous crime. I was aghast. Cars, trucks, and worst of all, white vans were careering down the slip road, none of them, I'm sure, expecting to find a couple of cars actually parked there, right on the bend. Any one of them could easily have rear-ended my car, with my pregnant wife inside. The situation was frightening and insane. I made this point to the police officer, who, as is so often the case with the police, took a different view. The officer's point was that overtaking on an inside lane was inherently dangerous. Why? Because the law said it was. But being parked on a blind bend on a slip road was not dangerous because I was there on police instructions, which made it legal and hence, this was the tricky bit to follow, safe. My point was that I accepted that I had, quite safely, made a manoeuvre that was illegal under the laws of England, but that our current situation, parked on a blind bend in the path of fast-moving traffic, was life-threatening by reason of the actual physical laws of the universe. The officer's next point was that I wasn't in the universe, I was in England, a point that has been made to me before. I gave up trying to win an argument and agreed to everything so that we could just get out of there. As it happened, the reason I had rather over-casually overtaken on the inside lane was that I am very used to driving here in the United States, where everybody routinely exercises their constitutional right to drive in whatever damn lane they please. Under American law, overtaking on the inside lane, where traffic conditions allow, is perfectly legal, perfectly normal, and hence, perfectly safe. But I'll tell you what isn't. I was once in San Francisco, and I parked in the only available space, which happened to be on the other side of the street. The law descended on me. Was I aware of how dangerous the manoeuvre I'd just made was? I looked at the law a bit blankly. What had I done wrong? I had, said the law, parked against the flow of traffic. Puzzled, I looked up and down the street. What traffic? I asked. The traffic that would be there, said the law, if there was any traffic. This was a bit metaphysical, even for me, so I explained, a bit lamely, that in England we just park wherever we can find a parking space available, and weren't that fussy about which side of the street it was on. He looked at me aghast, as if I was lucky to have got out of a country of such wild and crazy car parkers alive, and promptly gave me a ticket. Clearly he would rather have deported me before my subversive ideas brought chaos and anarchy to streets which normally had to cope with nothing more alarming than a few simple assault rifles, which, as we know, in the States are perfectly legal, and without which they would be overrun by herds of deer, overbearing government officers, and lawless British tea importers. My late friend Graham Chapman, an idiosyncratic driver at the best of times, used to exploit the mutual incomprehension of British and US driving habits by always carrying both British and Californian driver's licenses. Whenever he was stopped in the US, he would flash his British license, and vice versa. He would also mention that he was just on his way to the airport to leave the country, which he always found to be such welcome news that the police would breathe a sigh of relief and wave him on. But though there are frequent misunderstandings between the Europeans and the Americans, at least we've had decades of shared movies and TV to help us get used to each other. Outside those bounds, you can't make any assumptions at all. In China, for instance, the poet James Fenton was once stopped for having a light on his bicycle. How would it be, the police officer asked him severely, if everybody did that? However, the most extreme example I've come across of something being absolutely forbidden in one country and normal practice in another is one I can't quite bring myself to believe, though my cousin swears it's true. She lived for several years in Tokyo and tells of a court case in which a driver who was being prosecuted for driving up onto the pavement, crashing into a shop window and killing a couple of pedestrians, was allowed to enter the fact that he was blind drunk at the time as a plea in mitigation. What are the rules you need to know if you are moving from one country to another? What are the things that are compulsory in one country and forbidden in another? Common sense won't tell you. We have to tell each other. The Independent on Sunday.